thanks once again for downloading and listening to a podcast from Celtic Underground. We are in the 21st year and the 20th season of the world's longest running football fans podcast. You can subscribe by going to thecelticunderground.substack.com and you will get correspondence, articles, emails straight to your inbox. You can pay a little bit of money and you will get exclusive content straight to your inbox. And if you go online and look on our website, you can still, you don't need to be on the Substack app, you can get all the podcasts on your usual provider. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying enjoy the latest podcast.
Misery loves company. That's what the wise man said. The remedy.
I am Paul Fivey. I'm a big Celtic fan, but on a day-to-day basis, what I mainly do is I deal with brain injuries, specifically the rehabilitation of people with brain injuries, and I've got a bit of a, I guess, a side interest in football-related injuries and what have you. So we had a sort of long-standing plan, I think, to have this chat about football and dementia, and then obviously getting the sad news there this week about Jim Craig, who was the latest Celtic alumnus to be diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disorder. I thought now was probably the best time to get on and have a wee chat.
Yeah, so I mean, I just said before we started there, I will play the village idiot here and ask the really basic questions, and that's because my knowledge here is certainly less than yours and marginally more than nothing. So, first of all, you mentioned it, you call it the neurodegenerative illness. Or
neurodegenerative.
Yes, degenerative. So explain that catch-all phrase to...
Okay, so that's a sort of catch-all thing of disorders where your brain essentially is damaged over time by a variety of things. So that can be by inflammation, scarring, trauma, what have you. And in the context of this, it sort of refers to diseases like Alzheimer's, motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis. And the big one that's probably there is what we now call chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And these have been around for quite a while, and they've actually got quite an interesting history where there's long been an interest in what kind of trauma causes these and what things happen. And so I think when we look at it overall, probably the easiest and most, and I guess most accepted example is your punch drunk boxer. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was a diagnosis that everybody sort of realizes that boxing causes brain damage. I don't think that's a controversial statement to make. And so your diagnosis of a kind of punch drunk boxer, so that's called dementia pugilistica historically. Mm-hmm. And if you know your Latin, that's quite an interesting phrase. It was kind of accepted that boxing did that. But then there was a lot of controversy over the years about people thought, isn't there a lot of footballers getting a lot of neurological disorders? And for a long time, people thought, well, it's probably just because they don't die of other things.
Yeah.
And turns out that's not actually the case. Mm-hmm. So, if we go back, one of the key figures in this is a guy called Jeff Astle.
Yes.
You remember Jeff Astle?
Yeah, very famous.
Depending on your vintage, you'll remember Jeff Astle for one of three things. You've either got Jeff Astle, who was a very famous England international. You've then got sort of his late career foray into light entertainment, when he sort of got involved with the fantasy football guys, and there was this sort of Jeff Astle sings component of their show, which I don't know about you, but always made me a little bit uncomfortable, because he quite clearly had issues. And and then eventually Jeff unfortunately died of complications of Alzheimer's disease. And then latterly, his family have sort of taken up a bit of a crusade about neurodegenerative disorders, dementia, and football.
Yeah.
Because from their point of view, and probably rightly so, their argument was very much that, well, if this happened as a result of him playing football, chances are it probably did, then shouldn't that be considered an industrial injury? And if you then change something from being something that just happens as a result of, well, you're unlucky, you're just one of the people who's going to get dementia, if you then say, well, no, actually, there was an industrial component to that, you've then got a lot more avenues where people can find money to pay for care and what have you. And so that's where all that sort of comes in. So Jeff Astle's a very key figure in this.
And one of the things you were saying there about touching on whether it is an industrial injury or whether it's just your Donald Duck. So, and I'm always wary, as you obviously far more than me, I'm always wary of people drawing out from a very small sample size and extrapolating and saying, consequently, it is X.
Right.
And obviously, we're aware of the Lisbon Lions, where half the team have had some sort of neurodegenerative disease. And exactly the same, almost the same numbers with the England World Cup winning team of 66. Yep. It's virtually the same. It's what is it, six in both teams, I think it is, now with Jim Craig. So it's roughly both. So it's natural for people to then say, well, there you go. Proves it. But it is such a small sample. It's only 22 guys.
Right. Okay. So that's where a guy called Willie Stewart comes in.
Yep.
Now, Willie Stewart is a guy I've known for a long time. He's a neuropathologist. And Willie's a guy who his main day job is, if you've got a patient who's had an operation on their brain, if you take a bit of brain out, you want to know what's wrong with it, you send it off to Willie. He says, it's this type of tumour, or it's this, or it's that, or what have. So that's what a neuropathologist does. But he's also got a research interest in trauma-related changes in brain. So he was involved with a group who were looking at this in NFL players, because that's one of the big groups where there's a lot of stuff. And then, so they started to realise that there were a lot of changes that were being seen in the brains of NFL players, which were very similar to Alzheimer's. And this was happening at very, very scary young ages. So, for example, there were high school kids who, I'm sure there was a high school kid who died in a car accident, and he'd been having issues with headaches and what have you. So they took his brain out, looked at it, and were pretty horrified to find that, you know, biologically he had quite advanced Alzheimer's. And so there was a bit of a worry about that. Now, the NFL, we can maybe talk a bit later about how the NFL handled things, but they handled it very badly. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, there was a bit of a fight about, well, is this real, is this not? And so Willie was getting sent brains from all over the place, one of whose was Jeff Astle's. Mm-hmm. And he was very much corroborating that this is indeed what's happening, that there's certainly, we've got good evidence here that these changes are very real in people's brains. So, consequently, we then get to 2017, 2018-ish, when the football authorities in Scotland kind of thought, isn't this interesting? Instead of doing what the NFL did and pretending it's not a problem, let's look into this. So they got Willie Stewart, and they funded him, and I think some of the money came through Glasgow University, to do a study where they looked at, I think it's 7,300 footballers. Mm-hmm. So one of the things Scotland does very, very, very well, to the chagrin of a lot of people, is we hold centralised records very well. So the reason why they were able to work this out in Scottish football is because Scottish football centrally holds quite a lot of records about footballers going back quite a long time. So they were able to identify 7,300 footballers the youngest players that were involved in this would have been turning 40 in 2016. So that's the cohort that are turning 50 this year.
Yep.
So to put that into context, I worked out see if you can guess this. Who do you think that would make the youngest Celtic player in this? He turns 50 this year.
It will be, so it must be around the Henrik Larsson era-ish team, no?
No. Think about it. If someone's turning 50 this year, they'll probably have retired about 15 years ago.
Right,
so
it'll
be somebody that was
about
2011.
Oh, right, okay. I don't know. Who's the youngest Celtic player in it?
Paul Hartley.
All right.
So that's how broad this is, and that's the age group that they looked at in this. So they looked at these guys, and as many as they could, and the good thing that we hold in Scotland, as well as very good centralised footballing records, is we hold very good centralised prescribing data. So the Scottish government and the Scottish NHS knows what everybody in the country is taking medication-wise if it's coming through the NHS.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really good for doing population-based studies. So they were able to take, but I keep saying 7,300 like I actually know it. It's roughly about that number. It's in the 7,000s. 7,000 footballers. And they matched them up with three. So every single player who's in this was matched with three people randomly of the same age, same sex. And I think there was some accounting for sort of socioeconomic status as well. And basically, they then sort of looked at that in terms of the NHS Scotland database and said, right, are these people on any med? You know, what are the chances that these people are on medication that would be linked to a neurodegenerative disorder? So are they on Alzheimer's medication? Are they on motor neuron disease medication? Are they on MS medication? All that sort of stuff. And the results are pretty staggering. So as a footballer, your risk is somewhere between 3 and 4 times that of the general population of getting dementia. And that then sort of whittles down to you've got about twice the risk of getting motor neuron disease to the general population, which is pretty staggering. Now, that's what they also did, though, is they also accounted for the positives of football, because it's probably important to see this study was actually, it's called the Field Study, and it was all to do with sort of the overall effects of football on life. So footballers live longer, and you would assume that are healthier, and they found that. So they live longer, they have better mental health, they have better cardiovascular health, they have better, they've got lower rates of lung cancer, things like that. So overall, they're healthier, they live longer, but you've got this big spike in neurodegenerative disorders, and that's what they found. So it's pretty conclusive.
Yeah, because again, not having seen that sort of data, my initial thoughts were, right, okay, well, I can see why it would have been worse amongst Lisbon Lions and England World Cup team. I am in that 50-plus age bracket. And I have, very early memories of playing football with a much heavier leather ball that would soak in the water. And on rainy days, would be like heading a brick. So you are thinking, right, okay, well, I get this, because they're only really going to know this data for people as they're getting older. Right. And so you can see why it might have a disproportionate impact on the Lisbon Lions and England World Cup squad and other players around that area. It's just that they're famous because they are heading a brick. You can see that. But if you're then at the Paul Hartley age, he's not heading a brick. His age of footballer, and I only have the vaguest memories because my granddad had one of those balls. We didn't play with those balls at all. So Paul Hartley's 4 or 5, if by the sounds of things, 4 or 5 years younger than me.
Yep.
So he definitely didn't play with one of those balls. So that means it's And Paul Hartley's not one of these people that would come to mind when you think of people. You're thinking of John Hartson, you're thinking of Chris Sutton and even Henrik are people who regularly head the ball and obviously centre halves. Paul Hartley's in that part of the pitch where you're not thinking of people who are regularly heading a football.
No, you're absolutely right, and but that's why I kind of made that. That's why I made a sort of a point out of that, because I think a lot of people when this study first came out, I mean, I remember listening to Radio Scotland when it first came out, and they were discussing it, and there was an element of, well, you know, that's the older generation that was, they didn't pay attention to these things back then, you know, as you say, heavy ball, etc., etc. And I remember Stephen Craigan was sort of pontificating about that, and someone then sort of said, no, Stephen, you're in the study. He, I think, just makes it. So he turns 50 this year as well, and I think that shocked a few people. How young the some of the people who are in that group are. So it's interesting. This is not something that's just going to be a phenomenon of the footballers of the 60s and 70s. This is something that we are going to see this now, because unfortunately, if you look at it, the people whose playing careers are over, it's done. The damage is there, and the damage is done. So the question now for football very much is, how do they support a cohort of people who've probably got the damage that might trigger this off later on in life? How do they deal with that, and how do they support these people? And I think there's now a little bit of a there's a real question about what do you do?
So, and there's a couple of things, and you mentioned boxing there. I like my boxing. One of the challenges in life as I've got older is I sit sometimes watching a fight thinking, Brian, you're enjoying two guys knocking themselves. In any other aspect of life, you'd loathe this. You're enjoying two guys where one of them, and it's not knockout is not the only way you win a fight, but it's the headline aspect of how you win a fight, and particularly with big guys, and although it disproportionately impacts wee guys who are trying to make the weight. But yeah, I sit there sometimes thinking you're enjoying watching it because one guy's going to be knocked in a position where his brain's spinning around inside his skull so much that it's not able to make proper cognitive decisions in life, and you're watching that. So as I've got older, I have that thing. But the element there is everybody, as you quite rightly said at the beginning, everybody knows that's a risk of becoming a professional boxer.
But also, boxing, if you think about it, because of the nature of it and because it's accepted, boxing is very heavily regulated. So you have to be licensed to fight. If you don't comply with the medical processes around being a boxer, in terms of if you get knocked out, you've got to sit out for, you know, boxing's kind of got it worked out that, okay, it's a risk, but it's minimized, it's regulated, and it's safe. And that's one of the arguments about, well, why would you ban boxing? You know, because there are positives to boxing.
Well,
You know,
many
obviously.
of the things you've just said about the positive of footballers, these people are doing exercise. Invariably, they come from really deprived backgrounds, and yeah, so yeah.
And so it's how do you maximize the positives and minimize the risks? And as I say, boxing very, very, very heavily regulated. They accepted this a long time ago. Football is still kind of the Wild West on this. They've made some moves towards it, but I think they've looked at things like what's happened with the NFL in terms of the kind of massive class action lawsuits that they found themselves on the receiving end of. And I think football should be commended for having sort of funded this research and facilitated it in the first place, and then sort of making an effort to say, right, well, how are we going to change football? Because you can't look at something like that and not react to it. Because if for no reason other than it's a form of negligence, you know, you've got to react to something like that and say, right, well, okay, what are the risks? What are the where are the liabilities and how do we minimise this? So we've now got a situation where, you know, my son's 11, he's never headed a football. I'm not allowed to. And then you've got situations, you know, teams, for example, now are supposed to not head the ball the day after or the day before a game of football. We've now got concussion subs in Scotland. It is making sort of slow progress there a little bit. But the interesting question is sort of where do we go from here? Because I had thought, certainly since this study came out, that this was a very good argument for the sort of Guardiola-esque play out from the back type football. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm fairly convinced that the rule change that came in allowing the defenders into the box at a by kick to encourage people to play out from the back, I'm pretty convinced that's one of the reasons why they did that. But it is interesting, though, that in the last season or two, we've now got this swing back to sort of saying, right, set piece coaches, let's do more long throws, do more that kind of thing. The game probably has gone back the way a little bit in that respect. Mm-hmm. Probably are more headers. So it's interesting. What do you do? Well, apparently the maths are that your average footballer will head the ball somewhere between 70,000 and 80,000 times in their career. If you can get your head around that. So you're looking at 70,000 and 80,000 small brain injuries.
Yeah.
Of those, how many do you think are actually significant? Probably you're getting down into the low thousands, 2,000-3,000. So it's more about saying ban heading the ball, but you maybe say, right, well, can we minimise the amount of people are heading the ball? Can we get that down where it is down nearer your 2,000-3,000-ish? And that's your way that you try and minimise things. And then you regulate things like concussion subs. I mean, it's interesting that I had thought when concussion subs came in, you would end up with a situation like in rugby where you get people manipulating the whole blood substitutes mm-hmm. thing, the whole blood replacement thing. Remember was it a Harlequins player a few years ago had the blood packet in his mouth so that they could sub him? And I did sort of think watching the Celtic match last week against Hearts where Derek McInnes made a mess of his subs.
Yeah,
I was thinking, well, if ever anybody was going to get somebody to go down holding their head and claim for an extra concussion sub, it would have been him in that game. And I just thought it's very interesting that nobody, there's never been the slightest question of it, which is really interesting.
No, it is. So what exactly is happening to your brain every time you head a ball?
Okay.
So and then the what's happening to the brain in the severe issues?
Right. So there are, what we're talking about here is we're talking about repeated small volume trauma. So when your brain is injured, it releases a thing called a tau protein, T-A-U, Greek letter, tau protein. And what these do essentially is these can sort of clump up, aggregate, and almost sort of scar the nervous networks in your brain, make them work less efficiently. And essentially that is how you get chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is this sort of buildup of these proteins, and essentially they kind of just clog up your brain. Now, one of the things that people are quite keen to point out is that when you get your first bump to the head and your brain's a bit inflamed, that releases a certain amount of these proteins. And if you then re-injure an injured brain, you get more. And it almost sort of, there's a kind of cumulative effect of it. That's why you've got this idea about trying to withdraw people after a concussion, because mm-hmm. the idea would be to try and break that cycle almost. So that's why you've got things like, okay, if you come off as a concussion sub, you probably shouldn't be training or playing football for, you know, on an arbitrary basis, somewhere 7 to 10 days or what have you. That's why as a boxer, you can only fight a certain amount of time, because you don't want this sort of cumulative effect of the release of these proteins. Now, ideally, what you would want is you would want some way to sort of quantify or diagnose that issue so that you could say, okay, well, that person's had a bump in the head. Is that the kind of bump in the head that's going to lead to this kind of inflammation, this kind of damage? Or is it not? Because one of the problems we've got is, how do you diagnose a concussion? And if you look at the NFL, they've sort of now made it mandatory that you have to have an independent neurologist or neuroscience doctor on the sidelines who's able to make that assessment of the player. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to get to that stage in football, because I don't think that's realistic. But even then, you've got people manipulating that in American football. So every year at the start of the year, the players have got to sit and do a mandatory cognitive test. And then what they do is, if they get injured, they sort of take them off the sideline, make them do the test, compare the two answers. All right, okay, you've lost a few points. Off you go. But what they found was the players were just deliberately lowballing the test at the start of the season.
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't get subbed off. Because footballers, sportsmen, want to play sport. They don't want to be sat down. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it's and obviously an injured brain can't really think for itself as well as an uninjured.
No,
brain.
But also they're young guys, and, you know, a bit like planning for your retirement or any of these things. When you're young, you think you're invincible, and these things will happen to somebody else, not you.
Yep.
So you can sort of understand that. And then if you're not playing in a game and somebody comes in and plays in your place,
absolutely. It's human nature.
You're finished. Yeah, so it's human nature. So,
I'm okay, Chief. I'll play on. Don't worry about it. And then you don't want to get a reputation as being a player that comes off too easy or what have you. So, yeah.
I always remember under Strachan, I was friendly with Adam Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of, I think there's an education needed as well to the general footballing public. You'll still hear... Yep. Older pundits belittling a test on a player,
mm-hmm.
and belittling the principle of a concussion substitution. And as I say, I always remember Adam Virgo talking about, he always thought concussion just meant you had a bit of a sore head,
mm-hmm.
until he'd played in a game and got, it was a head knock, him and some mm-hmm. other player had banged their heads, and he had been in the moment had wanted to play on, but Celtic had taken him off,
mm-hmm.
and then he'd thrown up in the dressing room, and then the only reason, when he was telling me about it weeks later, the only reason that he knew that he banged heads with somebody is because he'd watched it back, because mm-hmm. he has no memory. His last memory in relation to that day was walking out the tunnel, and then he has no other memory until like the next day after he'd been to bed and come up. So what sort of is Scottish football, or is football in general, doing education of people about it, or is it still very poor?
It is, because I think they do realise that there's an issue to this. So I mean, if you go to, I don't know if you've done the Celtic Park tour recently. If you do the tour of Celtic Park, you will mm-hmm. see there's stuff on the dressing room walls about concussions.
Right.
You know, it's there, and I suspect there is actually regulation around this stuff being mandatory. I would need to double check that. I'm pretty sure UEFA games it is. But so it's definitely there, because I think if nothing else, the people with the money in football don't want to be paying it out to players who turn around in 10, 20 years' time and say, I've got motor neuron disease because of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, unfortunately, the kind of care you need for something like that is quite extensive and quite expensive. So football, if nothing else, doesn't want the liability of that. But, you know, also having people die into these things is not particularly pleasant, and it's not something that anybody wants to see, you know?
So, firstly, you mentioned there about the tau, if I pronounced it correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
And that getting released into the system, and that builds up in the brain. But you've also mentioned the diseases, and you've mentioned motor neuron disease, mm. and Alzheimer's and dementia. So firstly, for those of us who've been fortunate enough to not have a family member or somebody close to us who's suffered from any of these illnesses, do you want to just explain what they are? I think a big thing a lot of people would always want to know, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? Because they often in the media are sort of interchanged. And
Okay, so
then how does heading the ball impact your chances of getting each of these three, since these seem to be the three main ones?
okay. So Alzheimer's and dementia are kind of used synonymously. Alzheimer's disease is a very specific condition that you can only really diagnose once someone's dead and you have a look at their brain. And it's just to do with the kind of the type of degeneration that's within someone's brain. Dementia on its own just really means that someone has got if you like, a kind of global impairment of their cognition, i.e., their brain is just slowed down, if you like. So they've got issues around usually short-term memory, speech, mobility, continence, these kind of things. The sort of things that your brain actually has to work pretty hard to do. Just kind of spatial integration, these kind of things. So that's kind of what Alzheimer's is. I think hopefully most people have got a rough idea of what that means. Motor neuron disease is a very specific condition where you get breakdown of your motor neurons, which are the nerves which work things. So essentially your nervous system is in this has three jobs. It senses the world around you, it makes decisions based on that information, and then it enacts them. And one of the ways that your nervous system enacts things or makes things happen is by making things move. So the muscles that make you breathe, your breathing muscles, your ability to look around, to see things, your ability to get yourself around. So they're the things that motor neuron disease attacks. So that's often held up as being a very, very unpleasant disease, because until the late stages of it, most people are usually, not particularly affected from a cognitive point of view. People are often very aware of what they can't do. You can't cough properly, you can't breathe properly, you can't mobilize properly, and that's really very unpleasant. And that's why there's a lot of talk about, issues like assisted dying and what have you when you get into motor neuron disease. Multiple sclerosis, MS, is an inflammatory condition that's actually, there are various hotspots of this in various parts of the world, and believe it or not, one of them is in Scotland, especially up the west coast. And it's a very specific inflammatory condition where, if you think about your nerves and your nervous system as being the wiring of your body, wires are covered by insulators. So you've got, if you think about a wire in basic terms, you've got the metal bit of the wire, and then you've got the plastic insulator on it. Okay. And you kind of need both of these so that you don't get interference and so that things work. Multiple sclerosis attacks is when your nerve is when your own immune system attacks the sort of the insulating protein that goes around nerves, which gets called myelin. And that causes them to work less efficiently. And so if that happens and you get sort of plaques of inflammation at different points in your nervous system, that's why it's called multiple. So you get them in your brain, you get them in your spinal cord. And obviously, if they happen in your spinal cord, they can mimic a spinal cord injury. If they happen in certain parts of your brain, they mimic damage to that part of your brain. But overall, multiple sclerosis, because it's inflammation of your nervous system, causes your nervous system to sort of work that bit less efficiently anyway. So often people with multiple sclerosis, as well as having issues moving one part of their body or with the vision, is quite a common presentation of MS. They often just have a kind of global problem with the memory, the personality, these kind of things that goes along with it. It's quite a nasty condition, MS. Thankfully, it's one which in recent years there has been quite a significant change to how they treat it. There's been a class of medications that have come along, which modulate how your immune system responds to it, and actually outcomes for MS these days are an awful, awful lot better than they used to be. And so a lot of MS management now is focused on keeping people very well for a long time, as opposed to the kind of really horrible burnt-out MS that you see in older people. So fingers crossed that's going to continue. And then we can start looking at things like motor neuron disease or Alzheimer's in the same way.
Right. On that MS, my sister-in-law's mum, mm-hmm. who I've known her for, must be close to on 40 years now. When I first met her, she'd recently been diagnosed with MS. Mm-hmm. And she's still around. And I think they would say that the drop-off was not as was forecast when she was first diagnosed 40 years ago. So I'm aware of those types of improvements.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a pretty scary disease to be diagnosed with. I mean, mm-hmm. I certainly know people who've been diagnosed recently in a very mild form, and it's quite, you know, it really is quite a terrifying diagnosis to hear, because, you know, your mind automatically thinks of, you know, people who are really quite badly disabled with it. As I say, thankfully, touch wood, that's something which is going to be less and less of an issue. It's probably going to go the same way as rheumatoid arthritis, where, you know, you don't actually see people with really bad rheumatoid arthritis anymore because the medications are, and bizarrely enough, it's a lot of very similar medications. So, fingers
which
crossed.
Which is why I always marvel at medical people. The you know, I often, as an aside from this conversation, I often make the point when people are talking about lots of different things to do with the welfare state, I always say, well, one of the problems with pensions is how brilliant the NHS has done. Because when pensions came out, the average age in the UK was 64 and people retired at 65. So it was easy to give people pensions at 65 when people were popping off this world at 64. And now we're the average person's living to close on 80. So it does cause problems, but it's only because the NHS has done such a brilliant job. And I just think it's amazing that things you can, that used to kill people, and now people live with quite comfortably.
Yeah, but then it brings its own set of problems in as well.
Yeah.
So
on that, what is it specific? So I know we talked about it. So is there anything about football heading that specifically leads more to Alzheimer's or more to, or is it just heading the ball, releasing various things?
That's a good question. Now, it almost certainly is heading the ball, because we broke down the footballers that they looked at. And if you're a goalkeeper, your risk of going on to develop something like this isn't much more than the population at large. Then the risk is highest in defenders. Mm-hmm. And it sort of tails off as you go through. And, you know, it's certainly higher, but not as high as defenders once you get into attackers and midfielders. So it almost certainly is heading the ball. Why is heading the ball a problem? Well, it's a repeated activity. It's not something which you're just doing it once and then that's it. It's you know, how many times in a game is Austin Trusty or Liam Scales heading the ball?
Yeah, a lot. Yeah,
and so it's that idea of sort of compounding what is probably a very small brain injury, but doing that multiple times through a game,
mm-hmm.
several times a week.
Yeah.
And so it is probably that the repetitious nature of it that's doing it.
And you see, even and if you watch Celtic in the warm-up, and I'm only watching Celtic, so I'm sure other teams do the same, they get the four defenders in a line. And obviously, as you said, there's an element of the severity of the blow. Mm-hmm. But even so, they're chucking the ball up. This is before the game. They're chucking the ball up and they're heading it 20 times each
mm-hmm.
before the game even starts.
Yep.
So again, we've all played football. Yep. The guy whose head was like a 50p piece because it would go that way when he's trying to head it that way. Mm-hmm. You need to practice it to become good at it.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that as safely as possible?
Yeah.
So if you look at, say, American football, they've got big restrictions on how much sort of full contact practice they can do for this reason. Mm-hmm. But then they've gone and developed things like they've got specific helmets that they train in, which are bigger and more padded and mm-hmm. look a little bit cartoonish, to be honest. But they've had really quite good success in minimising concussions related to training and doing that. Now, the problem with football is it's quite difficult to see, well, how do you translate that into practice in football? If you see what I mean, because I don't, you maybe all you can do is try and make the ball a little bit less injurious, but then people are just going to kick it harder. Then, your set piece coach is trying to do it. So you kind of have to say, right, well, how can we have something in football where you're, it's like how do you bring that 80,000 headers down to a safer number? If you see what I mean, how do you make it as safe as possible without taking the football out of football? So
Get
that's again a bit.
Pep to coach every coach in the world.
Well, that's it. But and that's why they've done things like taking heading out of kids' football. And why they're regulating the number of days you can do it and trying to say, right, okay, well, someone has a concussion, take it seriously because it is a real thing. But that takes generations. And as I say, I had thought the whole playing out from the back thing was going to become something that was more and more and more pushed as a sort
But
of
the
health.
challenge with that in the real world practical element of it is how do I bring in something that deals with, well, firstly, teams then become more and more practiced as to how to stop teams playing out from the back. So eventually one team says, right, okay, I know how we're going to overcome the fact that we are being high pressed here to we're just going to bypass them and hoof the ball up the park and revert back to traditional football. So how do you see football trying to manage this situation? As I say, I can see a line drawn in the sand if it was to do with older balls and they say, right, okay, we're going to set up a fund for older footballers because they were disproportionately impacted by this, or you could see something like that happening.
But older footballers weren't playing so many games. That's the thing that I think modern football, that's where modern football changes. That, how many games did the Lisbon Lions play in a season? It couldn't have been that many.
No.
And if you then take,
Because you'd, what was it, 3-4 rounds and you're in the European Cup final?
And so a Celtic player this season who's going to the World Cup will have played a huge number. And that kind of that just that repeated trauma then becomes a thing. So that's one thing football's going to have to think about. But yeah, how do you change it? Because the beauty of football, and I think one of the things that IFAB, the body that designs the laws of the game and tries to think about how to do it, is to try and keep it as simple as possible. And obviously, the more you bring in to try and manipulate things, that the less simple you make football. And obviously, there is also then the caveat of saying, yes, the footballers are always going to want to play injured because that's sport, that's what people will do. So how do you realistically change things? Well, I think you educate people, you maybe make that point about the bringing down the number of headers in a career. You make things safer from a kid's football point of view. Do you look at how throw-ins and how corners work, for example? Do you do things to incentive to sort of disincentivize the whole punt the ball up the park? I don't know that those are that realistic, to be honest, because I think people are, that whole thing of the ball's in the air and you can create a bit of chaos and live off a moment. There's always going to be people going to try and play football that way. So that becomes kind of tricky. Or do you then, wait, I think it might be going ultimately, if I was going to try and design a system to work this out, is I would be looking at, okay, how do we actually measure the amount of damage, the amount of injury that's being done? So, for example, people are looking now to see, is there a way that we can do a blood test to look at the proteins that are released when you damage a brain so that we can actually objectively diagnose concussions and give people a better idea of what they're actually doing to themselves. I think so. At the moment, there's a lot of controversy, certainly in North America, about should kids be playing contact American football at all? And if so, how do you minimize it from there? And I can see them, certainly in the NFL, going down a route of trying to sort of push the medical care a lot harder so that people are actually, you know, if you get to the point where you've got a machine where, you know, in diabetes, for example, you can just prick someone's finger, measure their blood sugar, and you're away. If you could have some sort of way to measure the kind of tau proteins in someone's blood on the sideline after they've taken a blow at the head or after a game or what have you, and you could say, oh, right, okay, we need to manage your risk here. I suspect that might become the more practical way of doing it. But that's
yeah, you mentioned that the regulation around boxing and obviously things like moving the weigh in back 24 hours in the fight, because too many boxers were dehydrating themselves massively, and so there's no, you know, reducing fluid around the brain and things like that. I am always amazed at how much weight boxers can put on and take off in 24 hours. You know, they often talk about, you know, even guys down at 10, 9, 10, and 11 stone in that bracket, able to put a stone on in 24 hours. I'm always amazed at that. But the principle of trying to take as many safety measures as possible within it. So could you then see a situation where you're never going to be able to stop heading, but what you can do is monitor the players more so that actually it's players who are being taken out for their own care because they need to?
I think that's the more realistic way to look at it, because as I say, I think the more I think about this, the more you're likely to go down the route of boxing, where, okay, you know the risks there, how do we minimise it, rather than turning top flight football essentially into futsal, which is kind of what you would need to do. If you see what
you
I mean.
Need to have, like when you played five a sides and ball's not allowed to go above waist height, and if it does, there's a real stoppage of it.
That's not realistic, because I don't think people want to see it, and I don't think people want to play it.
No.
But even then, it's okay. Well, who's actually most at risk in this? Because there are then big questions about children in football. So one of the reasons why they banned heading at a young age in kids is because your head, proportionately to your body, is much bigger in kids, and your neck's much less able to support it and cushion the blow. So theoretically, kids playing football should. And as I say, the kids playing football should be injured a lot more in that respect. And there is very good evidence of, certainly in the US, kids playing contact sports and getting, you know, quite bad problems with concussion.
Yeah.
So definitely a thing. And then women's sport is a complete, you know, women's sport and women's football then is a total can of worms when it comes to this as well. You know, women are playing with the same. On the same pitch with the same ball, but probably much less ability to protect themselves. And so there's a really big question to be raised about, you know, heading in women's sport and in women's football. And I think that becomes a very difficult, because women's football you certainly don't have the same number of people to follow up over a period of time to say, well, this is how bad this is. In female football, because female football has not really been a big thing for more than a decade or two.
About a decade, yeah.
So I think then how do you establish that? Because that's the kind of the thing that's a little bit of an unknown at the moment.
I mean, is there any... This is going to show my... I didn't do biology beyond... I didn't even do Oak Grade biology, I don't think. Is there anything around the physicality of women that would make them more susceptible to a problem heading the ball?
Well, they certainly have got... We know women are more susceptible to brain injury in general than men. We know that they respond differently, and we know that the same blow to a head will affect a woman more than a man. We know this. This has been established. Brain injuries in women are it's a very interesting subject. And in terms of how the female body reacts to things. But yeah, we do know that just because of the biomechanics of a female body, it's like a lot of things. You know, female football players get, you know, proportionally get much more injuries than male football players. often worse injuries. You know, the your average female football player, I think, I might be wrong in this, but I'm fairly sure I read somewhere your average female football player will do their ACL at some point in their career, just because of the way that women's bodies are set up, you know, the angulation of pelvises and all sorts of, you know, anatomical differences that, as well as sort of hormonal differences with male football players. So your rates of bad injuries in female football players are much, 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 much greater, and that's before you even start factoring in brain injury.
So, if you had a magic wand, well, firstly, just as an aside, completely unrelated to football and Celtic Underground, you don't, for someone who specialises in this field, you don't seem massively against boxing, or am I picking that up wrong?
I think you've got to be philosophical about boxing. Boxing has recognized, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've seen people die as a result of boxing. I've actually been in the unit when it's happened. Because there's a couple of really nasty ones in the last decade. I think you have to be realistic about boxing. Boxing, as I say, is a good example. There are definitely positives to boxing. And boxing does try to regulate itself as best it can, and is a good example of good practice. I think the worry is the people I've seen with the worst versions of this have been people who've participated in unregulated boxing. Right. I have come across people who have been injured in unregulated boxing, and it is way nastier than people who've been injured as in regulated boxing. So I think it's one of these. I don't think you can pick your phrase. You can't unring the bell, or you can't put shit back in a donkey. Boxing exists. It's not going, and I think it's not going away. And it's more about how do you do it in a safer way as possible. I think the problem is you've then got it's the sort of sideline sports to boxing. So for example, MMA, UFC has got way bigger issues than boxing does. It's much less regulated, and it's much less safe.
I can as someone who's watched, one of my earliest memories is Ali against rubbing the head of Ernie Shavers before a fight. I can remember John Conte losing to Matthew Saad Mohammed, and all of these types of things. But hold on a second. Yeah, and one of the things I can't bring myself to get. I thought, well, I'll probably like UFC, and I just couldn't get into it. And yeah, so I suppose your overriding point in relation to that, without going down the rabbit hole of discussing the pros and cons of UFC and the MMA. Although, again, when we were talking that, I was reading somewhere, because there's more and more bare knuckle boxing stuff. One of the things that when the guy defending bare knuckle had made this point, it did occur to me, gets back to safety elements. His point was people won't punch as hard with bare knuckles as they will do with boxing gloves because they'll break their hand. Was his defensive of bare knuckle? You're obviously not agreeing with that.
Not from what I've seen. And the problem is once you start to get into sort of Wild Westy type things, because I mean even UFC's got, you know, knockout of the night type prizes for their events, and then you get into sort of absolute craziness like slap fighting, which is just nuts as far as I'm concerned. So stuff like that I think needs to be more heavily regulated. To me, I think you've got to accept, you know, for example, my 12-year-old plays contact rugby. Okay, there's very good evidence that rugby is as bad as football for a lot of this stuff. It's just because the reason why they did the studies in football is because the SFA held the centralised records. Rugby, the players were all registered by the counties historically, so they don't have the same access to the same
I watched a documentary with
archives.
John Beattie, and he was talking about one of the problems in rugby was when someone goes into the tackle, it was the shock of when you hit the ground hard, and that sort of make, you know, your neck bouncing up and down and your brain shaking backwards and forwards. And it was actually the impact of hitting the ground when you go into the tackle that was the problem.
So I mean,
so yes,
rugby has its issues.
Yeah,
and,
so
but,
getting back into football, so what would you, what, yeah, if you were given carte blanche, John Swinney phones you up and says, right, Paul, you're in charge of regulating football to have a long-term improvement on brain injuries, what would you do?
I think they're doing the right things. I think they're educating people. They are bringing in concussion subs. I think part of the problem with something like this is I think the more radical you are and the more you try and force solutions on people, the more you'll get, you know, the anti-woke brigade will suddenly come out of the woodwork and, you know,
yeah,
less regulation and all the rest of that sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, they're taking our game away from us. Yeah.
Exactly. You've wokeified football. So I think that's where you very much got to say, right, well, let's finesse this a little bit. I think so. I think education definitely is a big part of it. I think you've got to look after the people who are already in the system, which I think the SFA is doing. And you've got to give people a mechanism to sort of report when they are not feeling well. And then probably what I would say is the SFA is in a nice position as a member of the IFAB board that it can use its ability to sort of be at the discussions in terms of how you develop the game and how you modify the game to say, you know, there should be a mandatory consideration given to any rule change in football to say, how is this going to impact things? You know, so for example, there was talk about trialling kick-ins instead of throw-ins.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of one of the Junior World Cups or something like that they were going to do. Okay, we'll look into doing this, but there should be a mandatory part of doing that that says, right, well, how is this likely to affect brain injury in football? And is that going to lead to more headers? Is that going to lead to less headers? What type of headers is it going to lead to? You know, that should be a mandatory part of how the game develops itself. Because I do think that there have been very legitimate concerns raised in recent years about player health and safety in terms of the numbers of games players are playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a scheme. The people who go at the end of the World Cup this year, who have played European football, who've played in, say, England with two cup competitions, and a 38-game league season, these people have played an enormous amount of football.
Yeah.
And that can't be good for people. I mean, we've got very good, you know, look at Kieran Tierney, for example. If you think about what he's done to himself over the years from a fitness point of view, we've kind of run that kid into the ground. But then he's also played as a defender and he's been heading the ball as much as he's been wearing out his joints.
Yep.
And so you do have to think, well, what effect has that had on him cumulatively? If you see what I mean, okay, he had a period where he wasn't playing very much, but if you think it's very clear and you can see very clearly at the time where things have been in terms of his musculoskeletal health, well, what is neurological health? Who's actually even thought about that with him? You know? And it's because it's not happening, because you then aren't able to see that damage and you're not able to see the results of that for a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thinks about it.
Yeah.
And I think you probably do need to have some sort of a way where people are thinking, well, wait a minute, what are we doing here with the sort of cumulative burden that we're putting on players? We're getting better. I think we're getting better. As I say, I think was it. I'm sure Guardiola was quite good at sort of keeping track of sort of lactic acid buildup in players' muscles and things like that as a sort of precursor to, right, is this person kind of running on empty? Are they going to get a hamstring injury? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of sports science now looking at muscle fatigue, but it's all around risk of injury, which is, you can see why people are doing that, because it's a very, very much of the moment. If you can minimise somebody's risk of come down with hamstring injury, then that's great. You've saved yourself a lot of money and time and stress. But we maybe need to have that same approach to thinking about player health overall with respect to the long-term neurological health. How you do that and how you convince people that it's not in your interest to be heading a ball, 15, 20 times in a game, 3 times a week.
And it's also that thing of supporters. I remember, Arsene Wenger was one of the first people to start getting that in-game data on players' performance, and he used to take Bergkamp off at more or less 70 minutes every single game. That's because they had the data that 71, 72, 73 minutes his fitness starts to fall off a cliff. But the Arsenal fans used to get really annoyed because the whole nature of that was that Bergkamp was performing perfectly and would get taken off before it was evident that he was starting to deteriorate because Bergkamp was wanting to, sorry, because Wenger was wanting to protect him. So I suppose it's also about educating supporters as well as it is about educating the clubs that this is what's going on. And, clubs don't seem very keen on admitting to the outside world when they're nursing a player with an injury.
There's a gamesmanship to it, isn't there?
Yeah, so I suppose they're going to be reluctant to admit we are nursing this player because his data of late hasn't been great around, you were saying about if they could come up with something where you prick your thumb and you can start to see the chemicals in your system to know that this guy needs to take a break from heading the football.
Oh, this,
Yeah,
you know, this
football's
ball's been
been.
having such and such a headache, or this guy's been, you know. We've seen, because I mean, you can track quite nicely who's heading the ball, how many times they're heading it, what speed the ball's going at. You can probably, it wouldn't take much from an analytics point of view to sort of come up with a kind of cumulative head to ball stat during a game, would it? If you
No,
can do
and but can
automatically.
you imagine? We're recording this just after Celtic have secured the double and played in the cup final yesterday. Can you imagine? Liam Scales isn't playing today, or somebody isn't playing today because we've been analysing and they've done a lot of heading in the ball in the last few weeks. That's a lot of education that's needed on supporters and the football world around
But at the
that.
same, I mean, the problem is it's very difficult to arrive at an arbitrary point to say how much is too much, if you see what I mean. That becomes very difficult. So it's how would you go about setting that as a point in time, as a point, as a limit to say, right, that's too much. But I think if you did do that, and you were able to say that, you would now then be able to say, right, well, that's why you shouldn't be doing, he shouldn't be heading the ball in when we're training, doing set pieces, if you see what I mean. And so that then becomes your carrot and your stick around it. But as I say, I think the problem is because it's not an immediate problem for the clubs, because they know the players will play on. If they know the players will just go on with it, that's the bit you've got to solve, and it's not an
So
easy one.
there's no, and you talked about, was it Willie Stewart that was the name you mentioned? Yeah, so there's that, and you were saying you were quite positive actually about the SFA and the steps that they were taking. Are you aware of any other research that's going on in this just now that might be coming to the fore in the next couple of years?
Oh, I mean, there's loads of it, especially in North America, because they have belatedly been brought to the table on this around American football, because that's where it's all come along, and there's huge amounts of research going on just now about how to minimise brain injuries in kids and even adults playing American football. So there certainly is a lot of stuff going on. The whole thing about, biomarkers, blood tests for these sort of proteins that are released when you damage your brain, that's a big thing that's going on just now as well. The fact that you'll then have an objective measure of concussion, which will be a huge game changer.
Be enormous, yeah.
Especially, if you can make that a pitch side test, You know, I can see absolutely how it would happen, because the NFL has got the money and the will to make this happen. Because if they don't solve this problem, they are not going to have players. You know, because they've got huge issues to solve. So there is definitely the money that's there, and there's definitely the will to do it, and that's where I would see this going. And then those of us in the medical profession probably see that's going to give us quite a nice way of sort of stratifying patients who come to us with brain injuries, in terms of saying, right, okay, here's where you are, you need to do this, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then it would be a bit like, you know, the Formula One advances will then roll down into the car buying public.
Yes,
if you like, that's where I'm anticipating it's going to go for the next few weeks.
And then the final question about this, because obviously we're talking here about preventative issues in relation to footballers. Where's the research for all of us in terms of Alzheimer's, dementia, motor neurone? You've obviously talked very positively about where we're going on MS. Where's the research on the others?
Right, okay. So that's probably an important thing that we touch on, is, okay, if you're worried about this, if this is something that you want to look at, because I'm very aware that we're talking about a lot of stuff here which is going to be quite concerning for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, you know, wanting to minimise their own risk of this, or having played football, oh my God, where do I stand in this? So there's probably sort of two things I would recommend. If you've got concerns about brain injury and or you need support with respect to brain injury, there's a very good charity called Headway. So it's just all one word, Headway. They've got a very good website, a lot of resource that's there specifically around traumatic brain injury. And then going into then more dementia, there is one of the things that we sort of set up in light of this, is there's a website called brainhelpandhope.org, which is a very, very good, very comprehensive website that talks about how individuals can have a think about their lifetime dementia risk and how to minimise it. And the good thing is that they reckon that they've got this thing called the keys to dementia prevention. And it's all basically then about healthy lifestyles, dementia prevention, et cetera, et cetera. That if you look at that, then you can reduce your risk in your life of developing something like this by about 70%.
Wow. That's a huge change.
Yeah. So this, I'm very conscious that this is not a happy subject. I'm very conscious that this is something that will give, that there will be people who will be probably a little bit worried about a lot of what we've spoken about that there. So yeah, so Brain Help and Hope would certainly be my recommendation in terms of where to start from that point of view. And obviously then if there are any footballers who are looking into this, the SFA, as far as I'm aware, is running research to try and work out, okay, how can we work out who's at risk here? How can we help them deal with that? How can we make, you know, hopefully minimise the impact that this is going to have on a group of professionals, a group of footballers who unfortunately have now, as a result of their no fault of their own really, have now found themselves in a position where they're worried about their long-term risk.
On to you, Paul. How did you move into this field and become a specialist in it?
So I was a neurosurgeon for a long time, and then I realised there was nobody really doing brain injury rehabilitation in Scotland. So the west of Scotland, I should say. There's actually some people, very good people doing it in the east of the country. Although the unit's having a few problems at the moment. So then I sort of realised, well, I can actually make a bit of a difference to this, because I got a bit fed up of doing neurosurgical on calls, which is quite onerous, quite long. And then I realised that even then we were doing a hell of a lot of work to save people's lives and not actually doing much to rehabilitate them afterwards, if you see what I mean, to actually give them the function back. Yep. So it's all well and good, you know, doing a nice operation in the near yard, but if there's not a service to kind of right, say, okay, what kind of problems are you having after this, and try and put all that back together. So that's kind of how I've moved into this. And then obviously, with an interest in football, it was natural that you'd sort of go, oh, that's very interesting. I wonder how we can sort of make a lot of that work. Thankfully, I haven't met a lot of footballers who have been affected by stuff like this. You'll be pleased to hear. Yeah. But, you know, the numbers that we had through the field trial, while they might seem big, are not that, you know, that the number of dementia diagnoses that should lead to is not a huge number of people, but it's obviously going to be very significant for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But certainly things like traumatic brain injury as a result of, unfortunately, alcohol and violence being the two big ones in the west of Scotland, are things that aren't going away. And we've now got the scourge of e-bikes as well, which are generating quite a lot of customers for us.
Do you know, this is when you start to turn into an old man. The amount of the amount of young kids that you see on these e-bikes wearing just a balaclava, you just want to pull them over and say to them, look, son, just I know it's Billy Big Ball stuff, but honestly, just don't. Yeah.
I've seen some pretty spectacular brain injuries as a result of e-bikes, and it's the really, really sad bit about that is the people on the e-bikes that are injuring themselves are, as you say, generally speaking, young men. And the other issue is that they are injuring a lot of people, not only on e-bikes. Like, e-bikes hitting people is now a big problem.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's keeping us busy. So.
There's always something.
Well, that's exactly it. Is, you know, one of the reasons why there is an issue with neurodegenerative disease in football is because if you move one thing, you know, you give someone a healthy lifestyle and give them a sport, give them a reason to exist, they are going to go on that bit longer and live long enough to have these problems. So it's nice to have the positives of football, but unfortunately, you have to understand that certain negative issues will follow you, and it's how do you minimise that?
Well, on that cheery note,
there is positivity to this. You know, you can't start to solve a problem unless you realise it's there. You can't solve a problem you don't understand. And so certainly we're on the road to making that happen. I think what I would say is football is probably now at a stage with brain injury now where it was with Arsene Wenger and stretching and muscle warm-ups and things like that, when he first came in and had people like John Hartson having to accept that, well, no, you do need to warm up, mate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's spectacular stories of, a friend of a football writer told me a great story about, I think it was Oleg Kuznetsov. You remember Rangers signed a couple of Russians off the back of a World Cup?
That's right, yeah.
And they infamously wouldn't warm up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Archie Knox had get sent in to talk to one of them once and say, what are you doing? Get out and warm up. And he sort of looked at me, warm up? What's warm up? You know, warm up, get your muscles warm. Ah, warm up. Went and got a hair dryer, ran it over his legs and went, see, warm. and so that used to be the attitude of that towards warming up muscle strains and what have you. So if you imagine where we've gone to with that, I think we're now at the stage where, okay, we understand there's a problem, but it's how do you, as you say, how do you deal with it?
Right, Paul. Thanks very much, and I'll put the links to the websites that you mentioned. I'll put them.
I think that would be useful. If you can't find them, then by all means let me know. But
I will do.
Yeah, Brain Help and Hope and Headway.
The two magic.
Grant, nice to talk to you.
Bring me sunshine. In your smile.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision. and also subscribe to the CelticUnderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.